Hi, this is Midday on WNYC. I am Arun Vanagopal. In all likelihood, you've heard the terrible stories about what happens on Rikers Island. The corruption and abuse are endemic. But it's not just male inmates who are at the receiving end. A recent anonymous survey of 53,000 inmates in 358 jails nationwide put Rose M. Singer Center, which houses women on Rikers, among the top 10 worst jails in the country. The pervasive sexual assault and harassment at Rosie's, as it's known, is for some critics yet another reason to shut the whole place down. New York Magazine contributor John H. Tucker investigated the accusations made by inmates like Darcell Marshall, who was abused while being housed at Rikers' all-female facility. Ms. Marshall recently won a $1.2 million suit against the city last year, and she joins John Tucker to tell us her story. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Darcell.
Thanks for having me. Hi, how are you?
Great. So, Darcell, your complaint against a guard, Benny Santiago, and the eventual settlement, all of this is at the center of this story. Before we discuss all of that, can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up in Rikers in the first place?
Oh, you know, it's a beautiful day outside today, and I pretty much don't want to ruin that. So I'm just going to advert that question to my book. Those answers can be found in Confessions and Tips of a Black Girl Once Lost. And, you know, you can get that via Amazon.com or DarcellMarshall.com.
Okay, so let's just go ahead and mention that book again that you wrote in the wake of all this. What was the title again?
It's called Confessions and Tips of a Black Girl Once Lost. And you can get it via Amazon or DarcellMarshall.com.
Okay, great. So, John, maybe you can recount some of the details from your article about that leads up to this harrowing, I guess, situation between Darcell and this guard. In terms of just rounding out what happened, what brought her here, and, you know, what caused Darcell to have this very high bail, give us some of the basic facts here.
Sure. One of the things that you see if you read the article is you have a lot of trauma among vulnerable women perpetrated by men in power. And, you know, talking to the experts, that is not actually surprising in all female jails where you have a significant population of inmates coming in having been abused, oftentimes by men, whether it be a boyfriend or a father figure or a family member or just guys on the streets. So Darcell's path is in some ways not uncommon. You know, you can read the book, but I'm happy to, you know, kind of reiterate what was in my story. I mean, she came from the streets. It was an abusive household. You know, just the deck seemed stacked against her. By 13, she was a serial runaway. She found herself having to barter her body to get by because she needed to eat and she needed shelter. And she found herself falling into the hands of pimps. And, you know, like every woman who seeks, you know, gratification and security, we don't have money. You find yourself, you know, dealing with, you know, unseemly people like this who can completely manipulate and take advantage of them. So it was a pimp who actually brought her to New York. You know, she was in New York a couple times at the hands of these horrible, horrible men. And she was in New York for 2 weeks. And whereas she thought that her pimp was going to be her boyfriend this last time, he sent her out to strip clubs and there were two other women living in the house. So she was crushed, but she didn't have anywhere else to go. So she stuck around, and all of a sudden she's hit with this charge. After a 911 call was made by another woman in the house, she had fresh bruises on her face. The police came and arrested everybody. She didn't cooperate against the pimp, and she was hit with the charge of sex trafficking, which is the first, I think, you know, at best dubious charge, at worst failure. To think that somebody could be thrown in jail for $150,000 bail for sex trafficking when she'd been in New York for 2 weeks and sexually victimized all her life.
Darcell, do you have anything to add to that?
I have nothing to add to that. He's pretty much summed it up.
All right.
He's pretty much this. Not to be rude, but, you know, sometimes it still just kind of, you know, affects me to, you know, have to repeat this a few times, especially that portion. So I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Darcell.
So, Darcell, getting into the subject matter of the article,
yes.
Tell us a little about when you first met Benny Santiago, if you could.
I met Santiago when I was transferred from the intake unit on Rikers, well, in Rosie's, to Building 11 where he worked at. And, you know, it was during breakfast one time, and we just, you know, he was, you know, showing some videos on his cell phone and what have you, and my curious little mind wanted to go over there and see what was going on, and I did it.
And so what do you seem like at first?
He seemed really cool. He just seemed like, you know, one of those cool, you know, the cool uncle that you have. We all have one. And he just seemed like that, like, really, you know, just laid back and just cool. Harmless, just, you know. So, yeah.
And so the relationship, I guess, it takes a turn. Eventually it becomes, I guess, more intimate. And even all along at this point, he seemed like a relatively nice guy, correct?
Correct.
And did he give you cash or contraband in exchange for sex?
Yes.
Okay. Were you sharing details of your relationship with any of the other inmates there?
No, I wasn't.
And was that just because you want to be private about it, or does it have to do anything with the culture and your wariness about people around you?
It was a mix, a little bit of both.
Okay.
I didn't want, you know, nobody to find out and ruin at the beginning what was a good thing for me, because I wasn't able to provide for myself. I didn't have family, you know, sending me money and doing things like that. So I was scared, like, okay, if somebody finds out about this, I'm going to go back to not having. And then, you know, further down the line, it took a toll for the worse, but I'm sure we're not there yet. So.
Okay. And so when would you say your relationship began to sour with Benny Santiago?
It pretty much, I'm going to say around a month later, roughly, it started getting a little crazy, so to say. It was more so of him demanding for me to have sex with him, or, you know, things like, even when I wasn't in the mood for it, or, you know, what have you, it was the threats of me getting, like, beat up or jumped or put in a thing for no reason, or, you know, something stupid if I didn't go through with having sex with him.
The Bing is solitary confinement.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
The Bing is solitary
okay,
confinement.
Okay, right. So, John, tell us a little about that. This is a fairly common sort of situation.
Fairly common situation in terms of women being abused by staff members in Rikers. Is that the question?
Yes.
Sure. I mean, if you look at the stats, most recent federal stats, DOJ put out a report in 2013, which was the year Darcelle was in there, showed that basically you have about 800 beds in any given time at Rosie's. So 50 of those women are being victimized by staff. It's about 6%. And as you said in your lead up, it's the 10th. Worst rate in the country. When you take that stat of staff sexual victimization of women in Rosie's and you couple it with a threat, all of a sudden Rosie's becomes the number one worst offending jail in the entire country.
And this really affects the culture beyond the person who's being directly victimized, doesn't it? Because it seems like Darcelle was herself isolated when you had inmates around her who were, I guess, almost on the side of some of the guards.
Absolutely. I mean, I was speaking to a inmate who's upstate now, and she, the acronym for the Prison Rape Elimination Act is PREA, and she said it should be PREA with a double R, Prison Rape and Retaliation Elimination Act.
Mm-hmm.
Retaliation seemed to be, based on the conversation I had, the number one reason for not opening your mouth and lodging a complaint. So if you talk to people like Darcelle's legal team, they'll say it's systemic. Do we know with precision how much this goes on? No, but we do know that it's probably higher than the 6% if you have a lot of people who are in very vulnerable situations where they have to rely literally to call their family on the phone, or can I have a, you know, roll of toilet paper, on these guards. So it took Darcelle a couple tries It took Darcelle a little bit to make the decision, the courageous decision to come forward. For instance, there are other lawsuits that were lodged anonymously as Jane Doe's, similar situations, Rosie's plaintiffs, and it wasn't until they left the Riker system that they felt comfortable changing their name to be the actual name on the lawsuit.
We're talking about the issue of sexual assault and harassment at Rosie's. The nickname for the Rose M. Singer Center, which houses women at Rikers Island. We're talking New York Magazine contributor John H. Tucker, who wrote an article for the magazine about this, as well as Darcelle Marshall, who was abused while she was housed there. Darcelle, you confided in another inmate named Sparkles, correct?
Yes, correct.
Tell me a little about that. What did you tell her, and how did she, what was her response?
Well, she already knew before I even had a chance to open up my mouth and tell her, which a lot of people had already known, but no one said anything about it. She pretty much, you know, when she heard about it going sour with him putting his hands on me and, you know, me crying and us arguing, she, you know, requested to see me. She requested that we meet, and we did it. And, you know, she just, you know, upon meeting her, she's just like, well, you know, is there anything you want to tell me? Like, what is going on? Because I'm hearing so much stuff. Like, don't lie, you know? And I ended up opening up and telling her, which I was really, really scared to do, because I didn't know if I could trust her. I didn't know if I could trust anybody at that point. I didn't want her to go back and tell someone else. And, you know, it just becomes crazy. But she actually ended up calling IG or whatever, like the pre, what John was just talking about. And I guess that's what started the investigation. So, yeah.
And so did you have a very clear sense that that reporting Benny Santiago would be met with retaliation from your other inmates as being a snitcher, so to speak?
Absolutely, and that's exactly what happened. Once it did go to a higher level, I ended up getting threatened. I almost got jumped. I was put in solitary confinement with no food. They wouldn't let me out to shower, eat, or anything.
Put in solitary confinement by Benny Santiago.
I'm sorry.
Not to cut you off, but it was Benny Santiago who put you in solitary confinement. At first, he said that you were fighting with an inmate. Then he said you were fighting with 9 inmates, but nothing was logged, and he couldn't remember the inmates' names. That was after she made her accusation.
So this points to yet another failing. Not only is there sexual harassment and violence, but that there is it's easy enough for somebody who has actually been accused of a crime to go ahead and retaliate against the accuser.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to cut you off, Darcelle. Sorry.
No, you're fine. No, it's fine.
John, if you could just talk about that particular problem and the dynamic and why it's such a widespread problem, if it is.
I mean, it's the culture of silence. I mean, a lot of people, you know, made the thread between the mafia, the omerta, to the thin blue line and the police force, to a situation where this is maybe not open secrets. I mean, Darcelle knew that people saw the cameras. Darcelle knew that people saw the logbooks. Darcelle knew that people saw her with all the contraband that Santiago was giving her. At what point, you know, two guards, basically watched her go through the pantry, which was how she had her rendezvous with Santiago, from her workstation in Building 9. They said, we know what's going on, and it needs to stop. It sounded like they were you know, critiquing Santiago, but it's not as if they mentioned anything to Santiago. They actually said, you've got to make it stop, which is pretty intimidating. I mean, I had so many conversations with Darcelle over the, you know, 6 months that I've been fortunate enough to know her. I can't even begin to scratch the surface of what it actually meant in terms
exactly.
of how it actually felt.
Yep. Darcelle, we don't have enough time, but
I'm sorry, would you like to, what was that?
No, he's right. He's absolutely right. Like he said, everybody knew about it. It was as clear as day, but it was more so they were trying to protect him.
Yeah.
So it was pretty much nothing that I could do.
I'm Arun Vanagopal, and I'm speaking with John H. Tucker about his investigation into how women housed at Rikers Island's Rose M. Singer Center are being sexually victimized by staff. And I'm also speaking to Darcelle Marshall, who was featured in the investigation. Hi, this is Midday on WNYC. I'm Arun Vanagopal. John, in your article for New York Magazine, you write, any sex between an inmate and a guard, including so-called willing contact, is classified as victimization under federal rules. And under New York state law, it's statutory rape. And yet, it apparently flourishes behind the walls of Rikers Island.
Sure. So, I mean, I use air quotes to call the sex consensual because in any other space, you know, no means no, yes means yes. But when you are at the mercy of a man who literally has the key to your bed and can let you out, then statutorily there's no such thing as consent. It doesn't exist. So any sex under New York law between an inmate and a correction officer is statutory rape. Darcelle experienced both, of course. She was manipulated into thinking that this man had feelings for her, and then she experienced what you and I know as violent rape. But in the eyes of the law, it really doesn't matter. And one of the things that I kind of found when I was doing my reporting was this element of Me Too going from places like Hollywood and the media industry and Silicon Valley and what have you to places like houses of detention, where the disequilibrium between powerful men and vulnerable women is arguably more vast than any other space out there. And another inmate put it to me well. I was upstate visiting another woman who made an accusation in a lawsuit, and she basically said, you know, how much different is a woman who needs a powerful Hollywood executive to land a great role, an actress who needs a powerful Hollywood executive to land a great role, and me when I need a guard to make a call to my family or for a roll of toilet paper? It's the same thing when you think about it. And that to me was compelling. And Rosie's kind of offered the hidden face of Me Too, something that hadn't really been explored, at least as so far as I could see in the national media.
I'm sure a lot of New Yorkers didn't even realize that there are women who are being housed on Rutgers Island. It's quite under the radar for the city, isn't it? And yet there's this incredible level of violence and degradation that's happening there. How has the city's political establishment, do they just turn a blind eye? We hear about this perpetually, and yet we don't seem to,
sometimes, yeah, sometimes the best stories are the ones that we kind of already know about. So I think if I talk about the politicians, but just the society, we just seem apathetic to prison and jail rape. I mean, we talk about it. It's like almost like a punchline, but no one ever really bothers to explore. And these are real women, real men being affected. It took more than a decade to even enact the PREA law. Went from 2003 to 2012 before it actually got on the ground federally. And since then, the DOC has said over and over that, they understand what the problems are. They're, being held accountable by a really, determined and inspiring network of advocates that are trying to hold their feet to the fire. But not much has changed since then, and you hope it will. I mean, they've done so. Allegations of staff sexual misconduct are rising, and DOC will say, well, that's because we have more reporting mechanisms, which is a good thing, and maybe they deserve some credit there. They say they're going to hire more investigators. Maybe they do some that deserves some credit, but the needle isn't moving. So you just wonder who is caring out there.
Darcelle, did you hear about other accusations against Santiago while you're in a relationship, if we can call it that, with him?
I did, but it wasn't until later on.
And what are the kinds of things?
When I started hearing about him and like two other inmates that were involved with him at the same time that I was. So, but it wasn't until later, and it was absolutely nothing that I could do about it.
Okay.
Like nothing at all.
And what were the kinds of things, if you could just share that with
and somebody else that was like three doors down from me?
Sorry,
at the time.
If we could
and
just.
Then of course, sorry. And of course.
Yeah, I'm speaking with New York Magazine contributor John H. Tucker and Darcelle Marshall, a former inmate at Rikers Island, about the issue of sexual assault and harassment at Rosie's, which is the nickname for the Rose M. Singer Center at Rikers Island. Darcelle, tell me, in terms of the kind of incidents or patterns you heard about Benny Santiago, the guard with whom you had a relationship, you eventually realized that he had an abusive pattern, a style of violence against other inmates, didn't you?
Yes, but that wasn't until later on down the line, of course. Like I said, at first I had no idea about it. I was supposed to have, asking him, has he ever done this before, things like that. He told me no, and, that's one of the reasons why there should be a huge secret between us, because he didn't want to, lose his job or anything like that.
So let's get a little more into the story. I mean, actually, you interviewed, John, you interviewed Santiago after all this happened, didn't you? You went to his home.
I did. And it's funny. I had a great editor, Lori Abraham, with New York Magazine. And she said, you know, I want you to go to his house. And when I recount the story to folks, they said, oh, I can't believe you had the guts to go visit him because he's such a kind of a bad dude. And funnily enough, it was one of the least taxing or unnerving things throughout the process. I just having heard about his personality, he seemed like a very small, very weak, pathetic guy. And when I visited him, he was definitely on the defensive and looked pretty scared. So
and he denied all the allegations.
Denied everything.
Mm-hmm. There was a $1.2 million settlement in her favor, correct?
Yeah, I mean the $1.2 million didn't go just to Darcel. It was the city's what the city had to pay out. Santiago also paid out an undisclosed amount.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, you have to. It was a settlement. He wasn't found guilty. The money came out from his pocket, so you can connect the dots. But you have to obviously. The central tenet of journalism is to get both sides of the story, so you have to no surprises. You have to check in with everybody.
And tell us what his status is. Is he still working?
It's interesting. And inside baseball, I only got the story assignment after I got this last piece of information. But you know, the magazine wanted to know if he was still on the city payroll, and it took a while for me to confirm. So he actually had a stroke right before on the 11th hour before trial last year, so regardless of the stroke or not, he settled. And then he went, I guess, I assume, I don't know, on disability. But he's still, to answer your question, Arun, he's still on the city payroll. He doesn't go to work anymore, whether he's getting comp time or vacation time or, you know, disability time. He collects regular paychecks. So I pay for him. I pay his salary. You pay his salary. So think about that.
Now, you write about a legal aid lawyer by the name of Barbara Hamilton. Tell us a little about her. She's the one who was tipped off to what happened to Darcel by another Rosie's inmate, correct?
By another Rosie's inmate. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like this girl got raped and we don't know where she went, because when Darcel did make the complaint and they finally listened to her, which took 3 days, she was transferred upstate while the Department of Investigation launched an investigation. So she vanished, and people were basically, I guess the inmates said, where's Darcel? And Barbara Hamilton, who I respect a lot, works with inmates in Rosie's, and she made a personal visit. And that's how legal aid, which took on the case, the Jane Doe case, along with the law firm Clary Gottlieb, was referred to Darcel.
So Barbara Hamilton's been interviewing inmates there for years,
eight,
right?
Years,
eight,
yeah.
8 years, and yet, I mean,
this
why
story
does
they is very unsurprising to her. She probably read the story and said, this is boring. I know all this. This is, you know, I might have been outraged before, but this is the story of my life. She's the person who said this is a systemic problem. And, you know, God bless her. She's a bulldog and been fighting this fight for a long time.
Do you think there was a deliberate cover-up of the abuse?
I am not going to say that I think anything, but I know that the legal team said cover-up. And the reason why they said cover-up is because I'll try and give you the Reader's Digest version. So when the DOI took the investigation, warning to listeners, this is graphic information, but one of the reasons why the investigation got started is because Darcel, at the suggestion of Sparkles, took Santiago's semen and put it on her jeans after the last rape. Forced incident of oral sex. Sparkles said, you need his DNA. Sparkles had made a complaint, too, about a guard who had been masturbating in her cell overnight.
Entered, without her knowing, into her cell.
Yes, and left semen on her sheets. She didn't report it. Anyway, so Darcel knew what she had to do. Mm-hmm. So she had these jeans, smoking gun, and she stowed them away. And when the Department of Investigation took on the case, when she made that second or third complaint, they retrieved those jeans. Those jeans are unaccounted for 4 days. There was a lead investigation for the DOI, Department of Investigation, and he said, all right, I'm going to take those jeans and send them out for testing. they came back and they didn't have any evidence of semen, but they were full of a male's DNA, which suggested, according to Darcel's expert witness, which was unrebutted by the city, that the genes had been washed. They cannot account for the first 4 days of the chain of custody of those genes after Darcel made her complaint, and that's why they say cover up.
Darcel, have you heard, when were you released?
I came home from Bedford June 2014.
Yes. Okay. And have you been in touch with any of your former fellow inmates since then?
I have not. No.
I'm just wondering if life is, you know, more or less more of the same for them. There's no way to know, is there?
That not for me, but I'm pretty sure it's the same thing still going on, just with different people.
Yeah.
That's it.
So, John, tell me...
They don't care. They really don't.
They don't care, you say?
Nope.
So, John, tell me a little bit. Who is James Christo, and what was his role in the investigation, the botched investigation into Darcel's claims?
Sure. He worked for the Department of Investigation. He is an agent, and he was given this case. And he purports to have launched a months-long investigation. It wasn't until Darcel's legal team got the case, looked at what Christo actually did, and were basically appalled and shocked at how little effort he made. I mean, even if you could call it an investigation. So he didn't look at the cameras, and then the camera footage was gone. He had an opportunity to listen to a phone call between Santiago and Darcel, and he had it on a CD, that phone call, and then that CD got lost, and he didn't apparently think it was important enough to preserve it. He didn't interview anyone other than Darcel, and he interviewed Santiago for 5 minutes outside of his shift right after the day he heard about the complaint. He didn't interview any other COs. He was asked about all this, and he said, "I just didn't." And then you have, of course, the genes incident. So this might be a good time to, I guess, point out, you might appreciate that my takeaway from this. So a lot of people want to, you know, throw the book at the DOC, and that is true, you should. But what I find interesting is this is not just a DOC failure. This is a system-wide criminal justice institutional failure across the gamut. So you have a Queens DA, which in my mind lodged a dubious charge and put a sex victim behind bars for $150,000 bail. You have a DOC, which ran a jail where Darcel and other women get raped. You have a Department of Investigation. They say they've since updated their evidence handling procedures, but they, you know, basically followed no semblance of investigation at all. And then you have a Bronx DA. I'm going to return to the Bronx DA real quick. The gene that they could not file, they couldn't fire Santiago because by the time the genes came back and by the time they figured out where Darcel's file was between the DOI and the DOC, 18 months had gone by since Darcel's allegations, and that apparently pushed the needle past the statute of limitations. So they could not fire, I guess, based on union rules, Santiago. And then briefly and lastly, you have a Bronx DA who had all this evidence that Santiago was at worst a serial rapist, but at best raped Darcel. And they did not launch an investigation or seemingly make any effort to prosecute Santiago. So if you want to kind of look at a case study where a woman has been, an individual has been burned across all four, you know, levels of the spectrum, this is it.
So do any guards who sexually assault inmates actually pay for their crimes?
Yes. The Bronx DA did charge one. Again, a situation, and this was, I think the guilty plea was last year. This was again a situation where the inmate preserved DNA and he was charged and he was given a deal where he avoided jail time.
So, didn't pay so much then?
He's out of a job, he avoided jail time.
Okay.
I don't know what happened to him.
Darcel, you mentioned the book that you wrote after this entire experience you've had, and I think in the article, John quotes you as saying that you're trying to, I guess, give a message to the younger woman that you were in terms of what you'd like to convey to somebody like you, but at a younger age. What is it you want to convey to that young woman?
Well, it was pretty much written with the purpose to warn people. You know, everything is so glorified as far as being a stripper or even a prostitute or going to jail. You know, it's so glorified nowadays. And it was pretty much just looking on, like, you know, throw out warning signs and, you know, warnings of what to do, what not to do, or eventually what's going to happen if you continue to do it. So, yeah, I just gave them my story of what happened to me, and hopefully it changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so, too. Tell me, how are you doing these days?
I'm doing okay. I'm still recovering from all of this. It's going to take a minute because, you know, it really screwed me up, so to say. So I still have to go to therapy. But outside of that, I'm good. I'm happy, you know, I'm healing and moving on.
And you had to deal with some PTSD, among other things, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And are you with family now? Like, your relatives nearby? You left New York City, right?
I did, and I bought a home in Charlotte. I'm still, you know, mending the relationship with my family. We're still not as close as we should be, or quote-unquote should be, so we're working on it. We're definitely working on it.
All right, well,
but
good
for
luck
right now,
that.
It's just Nagini.
Her rescue mix. Her rescue dog.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Very important.
Very important. Well, thank you, Darcel. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you, John. I'm Arun Vanagopal, and I've been speaking with New York Magazine contributor John H. Tucker about his recent investigation for New York Magazine, Rape at Rosie's, along with Darcel Marshall, who's featured in the piece. Thank you.
Thank you, Arun.